Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
On today's podcast, director and comedian Matt Vesely joins me to discuss his new film, Monolith. My name is Justin Hamilton, and I consistently star in a one-person movie in my head here on Big Squid. It's nice to have your company again. I saw Matt Vesely's film in Sydney last night and loved it. So the conversation is split into two parts. One is spoiler-free, and then there will be a little break before continuing the conversation with spoilers. If you have an opportunity to check out this Australian film, it opens this Thursday on the 26th of October in select cinemas, and I'd love you to check it out. Matt shares some details on where you can see it towards the end of the chat. When I say it's Matt's film, it's Matt and his team's film. The audio production is out of control good, and Lily Sullivan is just magnificent in the lead role. And I really dug it. And it's been a stressful couple of weeks, as a lot of you would be aware. And it was nice to lose myself in a movie that was so well made. And you know what? Fucking nice one, Adelaide. You know, I felt quite proud of that little part of it as well. So congratulations to everyone who have really made something that feels different as well. That's what I really dug. It just had a different flavor to it, just had a different vibe. It didn't feel by the numbers, and I think they've done a great job with it. Before we bring Matt in, just a reminder that the next few chapters of The Ultimate, which is a long-form story I have written and have been producing here on the Big Squid feed, it's under the Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted banner. That's the storytelling banner that we have here. And the next podcast will come out tomorrow. And if you haven't been listening, the first two podcasts came out over the last 2 weeks. It's about an over-the-hill Australian rocker who is trying to get his life together, and he's just a bit of a mess, you know, just a bit fucking get your shit together kind of guy, you know. But you know, he needs to sort himself out. The people around him that he loves are just having a time of it as well, and he's got his old bandmates looming on the horizon. And while he's trying to get his shit together, he's having these strange dreams and this recurring dream about a world full of superheroes trapped in a dystopian future. And it's kind of horrific, because essentially what he's dreaming is like a Zack Snyder kind of JLA world, but kind of even more so than that. So he's not wrapped, and it's too much for him. And this story is a lot of fun. And in a way, it's a bit of a love letter to my time in Melbourne as well. The lead character has his own comic shop, which was inspired by my friends Mitch and Troy, who have All-Star Comics in Melbourne. So, yeah. Anyway, I've been producing them. The first two podcasts are up. The next one will be out tomorrow. You can listen to it weekly, and you can wait, you know, and you can binge it if you like. I don't know. I'm kind of enjoying the weekly vibe to it, and from the feedback I've been getting, it seems like you are as well. But anyway, keep an eye out for that. Now it's time to meet a journalist who is struggling with a recent misstep in her career. While she recovers at her parents' home, she begins to work on a podcast that investigates the weird and the unexplained. And soon she discovers a story about a strange artifact that might not just be alien, but also appearing all over the world. It is time to enter the world of Monolith.
Something awful is coming, truly.
I had a very strange dream, but it felt real, a vision.
What's this for again?
It's for a podcast.
You have to stop what you're doing. You are in danger.
This is a good story. I've got good numbers and people are really listening.
Do you really believe this? Or do you just want to believe it?
I want to know why you're here and what you want from me. From us.
He's here. I can sense him.
Some kind of sick joke.
I listened to the new episode and you sounded kind of messed up.
Really got under your skin, haven't you?
Please. Please just help me. I can't keep living like this. Please. I want to tell you a story. All you have to do is listen.
I'm throwing you under the bus a little bit here, but we did a stand-up gig together recently.
Yes.
And I feel like you're up to the task. Yep. So, you know, we had Barbenheimer yep. recently. Mm-hmm. And I was just seeing, you know, Taylor Swift movie has come out and Killers of the Flower Moon, and I feel like they've missed a surefire bet to do the Sweeney, have them at the same time.
Yeah,
could have fed off each other, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, haven't we learned anything? Like, this is how you market shit now. Yeah. What kind of movie would you like to have Monolith alongside,
paired with?
Yeah, to get that double advertising.
Well, yeah, you can't have it be too similar, right? I think it needs to be a really dumb romantic comedy. Something really light and fun, or maybe even like kind of bad. Maybe that would be nice so that we could come on top.
Oh, right. Oh, you don't want them to both be quality?
I guess that did help them, didn't it?
Yeah.
That did help Barbenheimer. So maybe it's got to be a really like great, you know, like The Big Sick that came out a few years ago?
Yes,
you know, something like that.
Mono
like,
Sick.
Yeah, Mono Sick is good. Yeah, yeah. Big Lift.
The Big Lift.
Big Lift. Yeah, yeah, that'll work.
That would have been a perfect weekend.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I said in the introduction, which I haven't recorded yet, but I will in the future, just in case you know.
It's the magic of podcasting.
Non-linear storytelling. It's happening all around us. I love the movie, and I'm going to talk broadly to begin with, because there's stuff I want to ask you. But part of the joy of the film was knowing very little and having it unfold before you. So we'll talk broadly, and then I'll get nerdy, if that's all right.
Yeah, sounds good.
Sensational pacing. Like, I was so drawn in. And I was locked in right from the get-go. And I, when I bring up this director, I don't necessarily mean like his tics and mannerisms, but, you know, David Lynch will let a scene play out. And I loved the how long something would take in a scene. Was that a stylistic choice, or was that, you know, you said in the Q&A last night, you had 15 days to film this. Was that because of, you know, the time constraints? Like, how did you come up with that approach?
It's a combination of both. So the script, you know, as we talked about last night, and the script was developed in a lab setting, we kind of knew that what your budget would be in the end. So you're kind of writing to fit a schedule that you know you're going to have. So it was always, we knew that. But we were sort of prepared for that. So those, we're coming in knowing how we're going to make this film work, which is that it's going to be a series of quite long conversations, longer scenes, not a lot of scenes, because that slows down your schedule. So we sort of know that sort of stuff.
Yep.
But in terms of the aesthetically, yeah, it's a lot of like long takes, a lot of not much coverage in a scene. There's a 10-minute scene and we might have three or four different shots. It'll cut a bit more than that, but there's only three or four different angles.
Right.
And that was an aesthetic choice. I was really influenced by... there's a Michael Haneke film called Cachet, Hidden.
Yes, right.
Which is a beautiful film that has some thematic resonances with Monolith, actually. And he has
I was trying to remember that last night when I got back. Thank you for reminding me.
Oh, wonderful. It's a really cool film. And you'll see, and you'll be like, oh, I see. Because I don't think Lucy had seen that one when she first started writing. We'd watched a different Haneke film called The Seventh Continent that has a similar kind of style.
Right.
But once she started writing, I was like, oh, you got to watch Cachet, because there's this like, there's this dovetailing of thematic. But he does this thing of like, he presents abject, horrible things in a very plain way. He just sort of like puts the camera down and lets them play out.
Yeah.
Not flashy, not trying to, you know, over-dramatize any of this stuff. They kind of just lets it happen, and it's kind of more terrifying as a result. So I was really interested in that. And letting the film feel kind of observational in some way, that you feel like the voice of the filmmaker is sitting there over your shoulder kind of directing you. It's a film about a podcaster who is investigating a bunch of stories. She doesn't know whether she can believe. Eventually, we start to think maybe we can't trust the podcaster who's telling us the story. And that extra layer of like, there's a filmmaker that we don't know whether we can trust.
Yes.
Am I like fucking with you because I've picked some shots that appear to be like... someone watching or appear to be like something horror movie is about to happen, but they're not.
Yes.
And it's all just about kind of that contract between a viewer or a reader or a listener and the storyteller, and how that can be manipulated. So that was the kind of theory behind it. And I just don't like things that cut very much, to be honest. I like things that, as you say, the pacing is so important, and it just helps you build tension when you can make those cuts really meaningful. And I was super lucky to work with an editor, Tanya Nimi, who did all of Rolf de Heer's films, or a bunch of his films.
Right.
She's an incredibly experienced editor, and I loved working with her. And so I had someone in my corner on that part that was just... she was such a big supporter of us doing things differently, and she was like, never let anyone tell you what to do, Matt. She was so good. Big ups to Tanya as well.
You know, as a guy making his first film, having an experienced editor is perfect. It's like you've got the super coach in the background kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. And most of the heads of department were... they're probably more experienced than me, but like still in the kind of, you know, the early stages of their career.
Yeah.
Wonderful cinematographer, Mike Tassari, great production designer, Jonah Booth Remmers, sound designer, Lee Kenyon. We're all like relatively new.
Yeah.
And it was this whole endeavor of this film lab that it came out of was about getting South Australian creatives, particularly heads of department, to like, you know, get their name, get their runs on the board.
Yeah.
But to have like in a few key areas, you know, the mixer of the film, Pete Smith and Mike Darren, they're like incredibly experienced. The editor, Tanya Nimi, just some people that can like guide you in that process is invaluable.
There was far out. There's so many things that are coming to mind. There's the cinematography is gorgeous, and there's one point where the scene in the foreground is quite still, but if you look beyond that and into the background outside, you can see the trees blowing gently, and it adds to this dreamlike quality of what you're watching. Also, some of your placement of Lily in a shot speaks exactly to that, because I'd be sitting there watching her in this specific position thinking, what's fucking going to come through the window?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like,
yeah,
what's
yeah.
going to come up behind?
Yeah.
And so there was this mounting dread I had all the way through the film. And it was great because there were literally, and I'm 51, so I use the word literally correctly,
yep.
literally two times where I felt the skin on my calf muscles ripple all the way up across my arms with
Love
that
it.
Oh kind
yeah.
of feeling.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's because you kept just giving me these references and never paying them off until you were ready to do it.
Yeah.
And it hits you in the chest, you know?
Yeah, we should say to people listening who might be wanting to see the film, things do happen eventually. And
yes.
And it is about that thing of, like, I really love... My favorite film of the last 10 years is The Witch. And... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, love that movie. And the biggest yeah. influence on this film from that movie is nothing aesthetic or narrative, but the... structure of that film, where it does this thing where it's like it's an hour of like an hour and 15 minutes of like pretty slow burn, letting
yes.
you kind of sink,
yes.
and then the last 15 minutes is just like just
right.
like ratchets up, and that was something that I
God
obsessed
damn.
With. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I love that feeling.
You know, but I think you're being a little bit funny as well. There's like anyone watching it, there is stuff happening all the time. You have to pay attention though. Like if you're paying attention, there's revelations happening, you know, consistently throughout the film, but it's revelations that speak to character.
Yeah, and that was big on Lucy Campbell, the writer. She and I talked a lot about how every scene, as much as they're long scenes, they really do have to have turning points constantly. There has to be a sense of escalation. And as you say, it's mostly about character. It's mostly about revealing Lily and the sort of story turning from... outwards as she's interviewing these people outside to realizing that the story is going to become her story, and
yes.
sort of hit about the halfway mark and that becomes quite evident. But yeah, I think Lucy has done a really good job of, as much as there are these long scenes with a lot of dialogue, the story is constantly moving forward in small and big ways. And while the kind of physical action is at the end, I think there's a psychological arc that is constantly building through the film. So I think all of those scenes, they all add something. There's no redundancy, I don't think. And that's
no.
a testament to Lucy's work. She's really, she's a fantastic writer, but she's very specific in that way.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, she really doles it out. And as I said at the beginning, I'm not going to give away spoilers, but I will say for when people see it, please keep an eye out for... the food that's being delivered, keep an eye on the fridge.
Yep.
Keep an eye on the tank.
Yep.
You know, there is specific things happening, you know, the window with the post-it notes.
Yeah.
Just the specificity of what is happening in every scene. And then, of course, you know, like, of course you pay attention to dialogue. But if you're looking around Lily, you will see... the progression as it's happening.
And we talked a lot about that because a lot of these one character films, something like The Guilty, the Danish film, which is about a 911 operator who's
right.
like, he's got a, I don't know if you've seen it, there's a Jake Gyllenhaal remake, which apparently is not very good, but the original is amazing.
Right.
And he's investigating like a kidnapping, someone calls him on on the phone, you know, in the call center, and says they're being kidnapped. And so the film is about, there's this real-time event that's like dragging you through it. Something like Tom Hardy's Lock is similar. He's like all
yes.
happening in the moment. It's real-time.
In the car.
And our film doesn't have that. It's all about like people regaling stories from their past and things slowly building up. And so it was really important that visually there was sense of escalation and change, because we don't have that kind of like really like The Guilty is so simply shot. There's like not a lot going on visually in that film. It doesn't need to, because it's just got this like click 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 of the story. And so we worked, so stuff like the, you say, the food being delivered in the fridge, all that stuff, that's in the script. Like Lucy had that in the script. And then Mike and I, the cinematographer, kind of we escalated that with, and working with Jonah, the production designer, to make sure that basically we divided the film into chapters and had really clear visual rules for each chapter, and there'd be clear turning points in the script. So it starts off, there's no picture in the first chapter. It's literally black.
Yeah.
Then we can't see Lily's face for the second chapter. Then you know, she receives a strange email and we suddenly see her face and just the camera can't move, but then it can start to move. Then she's less in the center of frame, the more the edge of frame. Eventually it's handheld.
Mm.
Production design's doing the same thing where her world's sort of very, it's a very kind of austere house, but eventually that starts to break down.
Mm.
And just to have that sense of escalation through the film because we can't rely on kind of the pure tension of like, oh my God, someone's dying in the off camera, like right now, you've got to fix it, you've got to fix it. So we're trying to find other ways to kind of have the film feel like it was changing and constantly building. Yeah.
How long is the movie?
It's like 93 minutes, I think.
Yeah, it feels even a little bit quicker than that. You know, for a movie that is just one person. Like, yeah. I figured it must be around that mark, but it felt about 65, 70 minutes to me.
Yeah, cool.
You know, I know I'm sounding pedantic with that, but it just moves along at a rapid pace,
yeah,
considering it is a movie that has a definitively languid approach in many ways.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a film with one person probably wouldn't hold. You couldn't do a 2-hour film. Well, probably could, but like we didn't want to.
Yeah.
There's something punchy about that. And we've been playing a lot of festivals, and I think you go to film festivals and there's a lot of films that are around 90 minutes. I think first-time filmmakers like that, but I think there's also something about the how you can kind of just, you can hold that in your head. Mm. And as you say, that the films kind of come in and they like make their point and leave, that I think is really important.
So you worked with Lucy and your producer, Bettina, really right from the get-go of putting this together. What ideas did you want to bring to the movie that you got to keep, and what were some of the things that, you know, Lucy and Bettina looked at you and went, eh, maybe not? Because it's always fascinating because, you know, working with a good team, the things that you lose are often defining for what you end up with.
Yeah, there wasn't a lot actually that we argued about because we worked so intimately together. So, you know, the idea was I pitched a one-page idea to them about a psychologist interviewing, a series of interviews, a psychologist interviewing people after an alien abduction. That was like the first idea. And it was Bettina who was like, what about a podcaster? It was Lucy who came up with these bricks. So it's like all of us kind of like gradually building this thing together. Lucy and I broke the structure together. Like we sat with a whiteboard and did the kind of turning points. And then Lucy went away and all the characters and stuff are hers. And so that you kind of just back and forthing constantly through development, which meant that we were really on the same page when we get to shoot. It's like, and I'm already talking about when we're starting to develop, I'm talking about how I'd like to shoot it. So things like, you know, when she's hearing these stories from these different people around the world, we go to these visions, we kind of go to these strange shots, empty hallways and strange bathroom full of black water. And, that was stuff that I came up with during the writing process. So they're scripted, but that was because Lucy had written these long stories and I was like, oh, I've got this idea, like when we shoot them we should have these like shots with no people in them, but they're like these long kind of interesting that kind of speak to how Lily is thinking about what she's seeing when she's hearing these stories.
Yeah.
And then Lucy was like, oh, that sounds cool, and came up with these three things. So that back and forth, man, there wasn't a heap of it. There's one shot, and this is like a mild spoiler, but you'll remember there's a shot where we cut outside and we see this huge kind of brick looming over the house.
Yeah.
That's one that's not scripted. That's one that I always said I wanted to do. And to this day, Lucy and Bettina don't love that shot.
Oh, don't they? Right.
But they let me get away with it. And I, every time anyone comes up to me at a screening, and it happens both ways, I should say. Some people are like, I don't get that. But I get a lot of people come up to me and they'll go, oh, I just thought that shot was so interesting and like it evoked something in me. And every time I give a little sideways glance to Lucy and Bettina, like,
And then if someone comes up and says something negative, you say, hey, just come over here and talk to me about that one-on-one.
Yeah. They don't need to hear this, yeah.
But that's, you know, I like it when a movie maker makes a choice. I like a choice in a film.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't always mean you have to be on board with the choice, but I like a choice because there's so many films that wash over you where you feel like, were there any choices made or did we all just...
And we were sort of aware as well. And the South Australian Film Corporation and the Adelaide Film Festival who financed the film were so good with us that like, this is a low budget film. It's our first film. If we ever get a bigger budget again, there'll be a lot of people telling us what we can and can't do. Mm. And on this film, we kind of had free rein to do whatever we want. So the opening of the film is Damon Herriman telling this kind of red herring of a story over black, over no picture. And the Film Corporation sort of said to us, guys, like, it's cool, but you're going to struggle to sell this to a stream. Like, that'll be hard because someone like Netflix, like, they need the first 3 minutes to pop. And it's really cool. I think as an audience, it's a really interesting moment. It's a choice, as you say. But it does not a visual, you know, if you're just like got that on in the background on your Netflix, you're like, oh, what? This isn't even a movie.
You'd be behind the TV going, hang on, what's something's happening? Wrong. Yeah.
That's why we make sure there's like logos and titles before that.
Well, you also, like, if it's the reveal of what it is.
Yeah,
Like, you know, like as someone who works with these all the time, I was wrapped. I was like, I immediately got what it was.
Yeah, there's a...
I know that.
Yeah, we won't ruin it, but it'll get it. But, you know, like, it was choices like that we were like, look, We toyed with taking it out.
Yeah.
And like the beginning is probably the only part of the film that we cut and recut and cut and recut. The rest of it's pretty close to the script, but the first like 15 minutes we did a lot of versions. And in the end of the day, we were like, nah, man, like let's make the choice. Let's make the bold choice because we may never get to do it again. And
yeah.
It sets up the whole film, I think.
Well, that's part of what I loved about it is that it didn't feel like I've seen. Like I think I've seen, 90 movies this year? And,
That is impressive.
Mate, I'm single.
Yeah, I've got a 9-month-old baby. That makes it, harder.
It makes it a bit harder, doesn't it? But the, like, so many of them drift away after a while. And, you know, it's, people, you'll see something, you go, did I see that? And you look at your little list. Oh, I did see that.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah, that sums it up. You know, it's funny now that you're in the movie making world. I'll be much more polite while you're here, and I'll let the listeners know what I'm talking about afterwards. But there was a horror movie I saw recently that was, you know, like a 90-minute hour 40 or whatever, and it felt longer than Killers of the Flower Moon or Oppenheimer to me.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, what is happening here? You know, it's they're kind of. It felt like the hits rather than having bold choices made. And that's part of what draws you into your film is that it's so different and it's not being created by an algorithm from a streaming site that says, you know, because now you see there's shows that you watch where, what's the one on Amazon? Is it Open Range? Which is...
Oh, I haven't watched that, but it looks cool.
Like, but it's like if... Feels like, you know how Amazon pushes things through the AI generator and tells you what works and everything, and it feels like, do you like Lost? Here's a pit. Do you like Yellowstone? Here's Cowboys. Singing? Well, here's a guy who sings karaoke. Do you like murder mysteries?
Yeah,
okay. You're sitting there going, part of what makes it fun is it's fucking bonkers.
Yeah, you know?
But you made me laugh yesterday because in the Q&A, and I'm sure people thought you were, some people, I think a lot of people got the joke, but like almost the worst thing that could happen to your career now is that you're handed a Star Wars project or a Marvel project. And I get exactly where you're coming from, where it's like, well, I want your film. I don't want you, you know, shepherding someone else's idea of a film.
Oh, I think, and look, that's not a realistic thing anyway, but it does happen to some, like, you know, you see some first-time filmmakers who, like, they get offered a big thing.
Yeah.
If their film really pops, which, you know, Monolith, we're really proud of. It hasn't, you know, set the world on fire, but that's okay. We're happy with that. But I think, for me, it's like, not just about that. It's also about, like, one of the great things about Monolith was just creatively, I wasn't biting off more than I could chew as a first-time filmmaker too. It's like, I've only got one actor I've got to like really concentrate on. You know, there's this one conceit of it's one person in this one location and every choice I'm making and with the whole crew is about servicing that one thing. And so I felt really on top of it. I didn't feel at sea. I felt really like I could make clear decisions and I was confident in what I was doing the whole time. And I think you can see that on screen. So it's like, the next film I'd like to step up gradually and hopefully we get to make a next film because the statistics on first-time filmmakers making a second film is grim.
Right.
But assuming I get to do it, it'd be great to step up gradually so I can still feel that level of like, okay, I know what I'm doing and like I feel okay about this and I'm not just trying to make it work. I'm being creative at all times.
Yeah.
Because that was the great thing about Monolith. It was not like we weren't up against it. It wasn't like shit. So many shoots you're on are just like, what can we do to get it done in the schedule?
Yes.
And we never felt like that. We were always like, okay, what's the kind of most interesting thing we can do right now?
Yeah.
Which is a wonderful feeling.
The Lily talked a little bit about this last night as well, but one of the things I was crazy impressed by is, and once again, it's she's a really good listener.
Yeah,
like she is. She's listening.
Yeah, yeah.
You can. Well, she's quite clearly listening, but you can clearly see cogs in her head working, and I was fascinated by that because she has to do a lot of listening because she's on, you know, on the phone or she's recording podcasts with people who are somewhere else. How do you as a director, there must have been times when, like, how do you say to someone, hey, you need to listen harder? You know, how do you give that kind of direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about giving them actions, actually, like giving them things to do. And so the one I remember most is the second phone call she has in the film is with this German art collector, Klaus. Yeah. And the really clear direction there was like, let yourself be charmed by this guy.
Mm.
Like, let him charm you. You like talking to this guy. What does that feel like? And as soon as, you know, you give that note, you can see her shift and find that feeling. And I remember that was one where Lucy, the writer, was the script supervisor on set. So we were both behind the split and we were watching. There's a really tight shot on her for that conversation. And this was maybe 3 or 4 days into the shoot. And I remember we were watching that. And as you say, it's when she's listening and her face is really taking that stuff in that we could not keep our eyes off the screen.
Mm.
Like, it was, she was so captivating that moment. Yeah. And there was this moment where, like, I turned to Lucy and we were like, holy shit. Like,
yeah,
we've got the right woman here. Like,
oh, she's so charismatic.
Yeah, yeah, incredible. And so, we were very lucky to get her. But I think she talked about this last night, that she found the challenge of, normally, obviously, she's acting with someone. And the way we did it is we had this wonderful actor, Ansuya Nathan, who plays Paula in the film.
Oh, Ansuya.
Yeah, you know Ansuya?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I only just recently found out that she'd been in Adelaide and nobody, you know, when everyone just
she's done all the comedy stuff, right?
Yeah, I know, it's through Claire Hooper.
Yeah, of course.
You know, Ansuya's the best. And then someone said, oh, you know, she's been in Adelaide. I was like, what? No, I had no idea.
She's there for about 18 months or a couple of years or something. Yeah.
Kills me.
Yeah, she rules.
Anyway, she's great.
Yeah, she's excellent. And she was working with us at Closer, the company I work with. And just made sense to... And she's a writer, and so what we did is she understands story. So what we did is we got her on set to do all the voices so that she was literally piped in from another room into Lily's headphones so that we couldn't really afford to have all our cast there. We were still casting those roles.
Mm.
We didn't want a recording because that's really hard. I did a short film, Sister Mara, which is about a robot talking to David Quirk. Mm. And David is a wonderful actor, but I pre-recorded the robot because it has this like flashing voice box that needed to be triggered on set. And poor Dave, it was like, you could see it was so hard for him to work with someone who could give him like I just push a button and it does the same thing every time. So I was can't pre-record, can't do that. So we got Ansuya to kind of be there. And what that meant is because we recorded Ansuya, but obviously replacing a lot of it apart from the character that she plays. But Lil could ask for things for Ansuya that maybe we wouldn't do in the actual take. Just to give her something to work. So she'd do things like, hey, Ansuya, in this one, can you really yell at me on this line?
Mm.
And that may not be what I want, but it's just giving Lily what she needs to kind of find the feeling in that moment. And she talked a lot last night about how she's a very physical actor. She just likes to feel things in her body rather than over-intellectualize things. So so she needs someone to like yell at her so she can feel that kind of, you know, that catch in her chest. And so that was a really positive experience, I think. And Ansuya was like fantastic at that. So, and I didn't feel like I had to talk to Ansuya too much, to be honest, because I just knew she understood story. She knows what has to happen.
Yeah.
And just very occasionally I'd go in and like ask her to do something slightly differently just so that Lily will do something slightly differently.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting about how physical she is as well, because part of what makes her performance really captivating is she's incredibly still, but it doesn't feel... relaxed.
Yeah.
Like she feels frayed, you know, her character's been through the ringer already. There's an exhaustion to her. But it's, yeah, that's a really interesting, it's almost like I remember years ago, James Caan talking about making Misery and, you know, he's so fucking twitchy and then he has to lay in bed that whole time.
Yeah.
And it comes through, in that performance.
Yeah.
And she's got that similar thing of being on edge, but where is she meant to express it? There's no one to express it to.
Yeah. And she would do things like do push-ups before a take where she's just sitting there talking on the phone.
Right.
Know? She still wants to have a fight or flight, like her adrenaline pumping or whatever it is to give her that stuff. And we shot not completely chronologically, but relatively, you know, the first week was the first third of the film and the second week, you know, within the days, not.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
But gradually across the shoot, yes,
yeah.
Chronologically. So you watch the takes from the end of the shoot and compare it to the first. She looks so different. Kaz Gower, our makeup artist, and Renata Hetschke, our costume designer, did great things to kind of feel the change in her, but also Lily's performance. And I think that chronological stuff, again, allows her to just feel that way. She's starting to kind of fucking lose her mind in real life because she's just been acting for 3 weeks with no one else, just staring at a wall while the rest of the crew is just kind of like huddled around her in this, like, in this house. So, anything you can do to support the actor, it's like the only thing that matters. So that was my main job, was not giving notes because they're long scenes. You can't be like, okay, on this line, I want you to, you know, a little bit, but not much. It was mostly just about supporting the environment around her so she can do the thing she needs to do.
Yeah. Hang on. So let me just mark down. We're 28 minutes in.
Yeah.
And I want to get into spoilers.
Whoa.
Now, mate, I had such a good time. Cool. I had such a good time at your film, and then I came home and I fucking thought about it heaps.
Okay,
and
cool.
Then I sat here like a fucking lonely man on a Saturday night thinking, thank fuck I have this podcast tomorrow. So there was some of the things that I found fascinating was that I just kind of I kind of felt the sci-fi side. Like you said, you think of it as a science fiction film.
Yeah.
I felt the sci-fi, but I also keenly felt the horror. But it's, you know, I got out Alan Moore's Providence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it felt like, I don't know what the intention was. It didn't feel like an alien invasion from planet over there. It felt like alien invasion from somewhere we don't really understand.
Coming
into our world, coming in at different points as well, because they probably have a different concept of what our timeline and our reality is.
Yeah.
And I fucking loved it because also the reveal of the brick was nothing like what I pictured in my head.
Cool.
So when I saw the brick, it was fucking disgusting, man. And I loved it.
Yeah, cool.
Because I was thinking of something like, or like when you, the description of it is like it's going to be like a dwarf star kind of condensed into this hard, smooth thing.
Yeah.
And when you see it, it's like it feels like someone's been chewing on a Jew blowing.
It's a bit it's organic,
no good
and stuff.
We
play with that of whether it should be like a, you know, a very smooth kind of like more manufactured thing.
Yeah,
and sometimes I kind of wish we'd done that. They would have felt quite alien as well. But I think, you know, what we landed on in the day was that it should feel like it came from her. You know, that it's like something. It's like a part of her that's kind of congealed or something. Yeah, I mean, not specifically Providence, but definitely that Lovecraftian kind of cosmic horror thing is something I'm obsessed with. I love like Junji Ito and just the uncanny horror that we can't fully understand or fully describe is definitely a feeling that I love and that we wanted to evoke. And, you know, Lucy particularly has a quite... The other thing that we were really concerned with is like I hate horror movies where it's just the metaphor. Like the metaphor is fine and we want the film to be about something, but you kind of want, you want the scary thing to be really happening, you know, like,
yeah,
And so it was really important to Lucy and I that, like, yeah, yeah, and then at the end, some fucking shit goes down, you know, and
yes.
this is, like, really happening. And that you, it can exist on two levels. It can exist on that metaphor or the thematic level, but it, the top layer can be, like, you can plot out, like, what's happened and what this invasion looks like. And so some of that stuff, you know, the specifics of how that's working, Lucy's got an answer to. Some of it is, like, stuff that is... you can pick out from the film, but you might not. And some of it's stuff that we're okay with you not understanding. And I think, again, it's just like that feeling of like asking questions and wanting to know the answer, but never quite being given it and having to bring your own interpretation to it. That resonates with the theme about truth and the, you know, the privilege of owning a story and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And there's something fascinating about Lucy where, you know, like you quite clearly with what you give us at the start, you're on her side. She's been hard done by with some situation with this journalist kind of thing, and then as it plays out, first thing I think I said to you before we started recording, I looked at the house that you picked that she's in, and I immediately just went, ugh, she comes from money.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then that's really important.
Yeah.
And as it plays out, the metaphor I was taking from it is, and when she comes face to face with, you know, the horror of it all is that she has to face who she really is. And she's been living a life that she's been feeling pretty, you know, on top of everything, and that she's right. And then in the end, she literally is face to face with how awful she is.
Exactly.
In many ways. And, exactly, and it still works as the metaphor.
Exactly. And that's the idea of... she kind of thinks she's one of the good guys for so long, and that kind of turning around and being like, you're actually part of the problem is, you know, something I think we're all grappling with at the moment, particularly us middle-class white folks are kind of recognizing that we can be allies, but we still have that privilege, and that how much we've benefited from that is can be very confronting. And that is a part of the story that we wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the experience that Lily's character kind of goes through, as you say. And I think that is an important part of it as well, is to give a really clear kind of character arc to the film. That was probably the one thing. The first draft of the script was actually very strong, and like narratively was kind of all there.
Mm.
And the things that built in the drafts, the subsequent drafts as we were going to shoot, were that character stuff, like making that really clear, finding a really clear trajectory for her, filling in those little pieces of backstory. There's not too much of it, but enough so you can kind of understand. The house is like a really important character. The first houses we were looking at was originally set on the coast with like these great limestone cliffs in South Australia, which have amazing views, and that was the theory. We couldn't quite find a house that spoke to that privilege so quickly.
Right.
And you want that turning point to be really acute. Like the moment, it's about 20 minutes into the film, she steps out of her recording booth into the rest of the house.
Right.
And you're like, whoa, look at this house.
Yeah.
And you need that to feel that. So Scott McCartan, our locations manager, I said to him, like, just go find me the most amazing house you can. And he succeeded.
He over-delivered. Yeah. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And the family that... we hired the house from were so lovely and accommodating to us. I think they're very proud of their house, as they should be. It is beautiful. We were very lucky to get that. It adds production value to the film too. It's like a cheap movie, but in this incredible location with all this light and amazing angles that you can do. So we're so lucky that they agreed to it.
And I'm guessing those blinds are theirs as well.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, once again, sometimes when those slow, while the scene is happening and Lily's talking, you're watching the blinds go up in the background, like you're feeling anxious about what's going to be there.
Yeah.
Also, you know, it's a brick. Yeah. Like I'm like looking back on it and knowing that you did this is for a good tight budget. Of course you weren't going to smash a window, but it's a brick.
Yeah.
Like I kept waiting for a brick to come through the
thought of that. Yeah, window, totally.
You know, so I had that anxiety all the way through.
Those windows, that's like Portuguese imported glass, these giant sheets. There's no way we're throwing a brick through it.
I'm surprised you even put the post-it notes on it.
Like, totally, yeah. Very nervous all the time. Yeah.
Be very careful taking that off. Was it always a brick, or was it did you have a different shape in mind at all? Or
the original pitch, and one of the reasons it's called Monolith is because at the time, like 2021, late 2020 maybe, there was, I don't know if you remember, that like someone was putting up all these 2001 style monoliths around the world. They kept appearing in like these metal plinths.
I do remember that. Yeah,
just in like the desert in Arizona. Yeah. And people are like, what is this? And all around the world. And
did anyone ever explain that?
I can't remember. I think they probably did. I mean, it was just someone doing a kind of art installation prank thing.
But yeah, it was good though.
It was cool. Yeah. And originally our idea for this film that we first pitched was like, that's what she's investigating. And then it turns out maybe it's real. What seems like an art prank turns out there's a truth to it.
Yeah.
And we lost that eventually. And Lucy came up with the bricks actually quite quickly.
Mm.
But we kept the title because there's like a thematic feeling of, you know, monolithic power structure or something. Mm. And they're still obviously these little objects that felt right.
But that, I think, you know, how you mentioned the idea of like having something smooth. But I think because of 2001, that's what I was kind of picturing.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Then,
yeah.
And then to have this thing where, like if I saw it here now, I wouldn't touch it.
Yeah, yeah,
it looked gross.
Yeah,
it looked like it stank as well.
We put a lot of goo on it too. Yeah, just blood and.
So I really like that. The recently I had to fly to overseas. I went to South Korea and I just rewatched. You know, when you have all these plans of all the things you're going to do on the flight, and then you look on the in-house entertainment, and it was like season one of True Detective. I was like, oh, no, I'm going back into this bad boy. Yep. And still one of my favorite things. But one of the things that was in my head from that while I was watching yours is there's that point where McConaughey is really upsetting Harrelson at the Christian revival where he talks about religion being a language virus.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
And there's something of that for me in your movie as well, of language being a virus, and that's how, you know, whatever this thing is going to be spreading. And I just started in my head projecting that at some point all these bricks will become the monolith as well.
Yeah, yeah. The language virus thing, I mean, there's obviously that's about... When we started writing the film, we were like, you know, it's 2021 and everyone's talking about post-truth and fake news and all this stuff and conspiracy theories, QAnon's blowing up.
Yeah.
There's this sense that... you have a great responsibility in spreading anything, you know, like, and as a podcaster, she deals with the kind of great challenge of like, I could make the thing that I know people will want to listen to, or I can make the thing that is more reflective of the truth.
Right.
And she struggles with that.
Right.
And so we were really interested in the way language and the way communication has changed and it's so fraught now. Like, it's so cliche to talk about post-truth. And I'm really glad that Lucy actually found a different thematic about this thing about privilege and class that really holds the film together. Because I think that post-truth thing is a bit pat now. It's just kind of been overdone. But it's still present in the film of this idea of like, you know, how can we believe anything that we hear? And like and it's like a thing that kids going through school now are going to have to learn. They're going to have to teach them to be much more critical of the sources that they're getting in a way that we didn't have to when we were kids. We're just like, if we read a book and it's been published, well, that's the fucking truth.
Yeah.
And the early days of the internet, even mostly, you were like, well, I can go to this website and that's probably the truth. And now it's like, you can't even believe the videos that you see. They're probably fake. And it's, it's super terrifying.
Oh, even just suggestions on Instagram. And then it's like, you know, recently, what did I click on? I clicked on a Stranger Things because it was like an article about that. And then, of course, you start getting all the actors and involved in that start being suggested that you want to see.
Yeah.
And then there was one of Millie Brown where you look and you go, that doesn't seem right. And then you're looking, you're going, that's not her body.
Yeah,
that's not her body. That is quite clearly someone. And that's just flicking through, not giving a shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? I think people have lost the ability to... Like, we have to encourage people to cross-reference. Like, you can't just read something and go, yep, that's the truth. What you got to do is look at something over here and look at something over here and read something here and, you know, takes up more time. But you have to...
You're going to have to do it. Yeah. It's quite a process now to kind of... But I think, you know, having healthy skepticism is good. So you hope that especially the next generation will all grow up skeptics. I think it's probably in our generations that it's like a little bit harder because we've had that period where we can trust things. Mm. We're probably more easily manipulated than the younger kids, I reckon.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, like, so Gen X was not, you know, ask questions, but what happens over time is, you know, the militant conservative right takes the interesting side of the left and co-opts it. So once upon a time, in the 90s, the reason the X-Files takes off is that Mulder's our guy. Like, yeah, Mulder's, yeah. Mulder's representing everything that, you know, he is questioning the truth and he's digging into it. But now...
He'd be an alt-right champion, wouldn't he?
He'd be an alt-right... Like, and that's why you can't bring the X-Files back.
Yeah, totally.
It's done. It's cooked. Yeah. You know,
And we talked about this in the making of this film because we're talking about the danger of conspiracy, but of course at the end, it's some of it's proven correct in this film. And we've had people, we've had reviewers kind of bring that up and be like, well, aren't you just part of the problem? I guess my counter argument to that would be that we'd much prefer a film that you have to talk about and provokes a response and means you have to have a discussion about these issues rather than one that really plainly just goes, conspiracy, bad, truth, real, the end. You know, it's like, it's just that there's not, like, I don't think that's as powerful as presenting you with something that you have to kind of like figure out and talk about this stuff, even if you go, well, isn't the ending of the film kind of like reinforcing some of those dangerous ideas? And we go, yeah, maybe it is. What does that mean? Let's talk about that. I think that's just a more interesting way to go. I also think it means you can smuggle those ideas into kind of what is a genre film as well. Like, people can have fun watching the movie, but it's still talking about that stuff.
Yeah. Well, everyone's actions are questionable in some way, even the, you know, the young girl that, you know, was blamed for everything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, her actions are questionable. The dad who you look at and you think, wow, that was an awful way to deal with that. But also he was pretty freaked out.
Yeah.
You know,
and
he was thinking, you know, he believed his daughter. Yeah. So hang on, well, he loved his daughter and he believed what she said. So you know, it's not black and white, which is what makes it really interesting.
Exactly. And I think the place of film is not to be like a school lesson. The place of film is to be interesting and provoke a conversation. It's to talk about that stuff in a conversational way or an argumentative way or a way that provokes you. And so, yeah, it's a funny, like, I get the argument that, like, are we part of the problem by making a film about a conspiracy that turns out to be true?
Right.
But, like, at the same time, I just think if we made it the other way, it would feel like, a back-to-school special or something, and you'd just be like, well, that's, okay, cool, thanks.
And then it was all a dream.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You know, that's kind of what it was, if you do it that way. So you're kind of damned if you do it, damned if you don't in that regard. It was interesting. Have you seen Killers of the Flower Moon?
No, not yet. No,
It's funny. I'm going to speak broadly because you haven't seen it yet, but there was a criticism leveled at it that like one of the main characters was shown to have... In regards to some critics, too much empathy. And it's funny, I didn't read that all the way through the film.
Yeah.
I read that this character was quite awful. And, you know, you can kind of have... I don't think having moments of realization actually speak to the greater idea of empathy. Mm-hmm. He says trying to be broad, not to...
Yeah.
You know, and I think her character, you know, she has moments where... the truth is hitting her, but then you can see her almost pushing it aside. And I think it's really fascinating that when when she vomits up that brick, and then by the way, the scene that was the highlight of the movie for me was when Lily looks in and can see that there's this new version of her growing, and the way her head turns back and the look on her face of fuck.
It's pretty funny, actually.
That's the best comedy. The best horror is kind of gives you that reaction of like it's funny, but it's also horrific because it's also truthful, you know? It's fascinating that when she comes face to face with this version of herself, her instinct is to run. You know, rather than face it down, you
know?
Yeah, I... I thought it was great.
Yeah,
I really loved it. And you know, the manifestation of the giant kind of monolith brick over the house. I'm not asking for intentions. I read that as metaphor.
Yeah.
That's how I read it. Like, you know, this thing is looming. Yeah. But also, because I was using that, my approach while watching the film was, whatever is coming is viewing where we live at such a different vantage point. It's coming in at, you know, it's coming in the past, and it's coming in through the future, and it's coming through now. And so it's just kind of, you know, that's how it's manifesting.
I mean, I have my own version of what that shot is, but but actually, your job as a filmmaker is to be, as much as you can, in control of the audience's experience of the film. And so it's less about you going, what am I saying with this? And more about, what are the possible things that the audience could take in this moment? And how can I make sure it's leaning one way or the other? Or what do I want them to feel? What do I want them to be thinking about in this particular moment? And as you say, the whole reason that shot is there is to, like, at that moment in the film where we're at, because it's not quite halfway, I want you to be asking a bunch of questions about what am I seeing and what does it mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's actually all I really care about is I want you to have that feeling. So you going, okay, what does that mean? And trying, having these different interpretations of it. That's the only experience I want you to have, whichever ones you find is up to you.
Yeah.
But that's totally the point of it.
I'm going to call Bettina now and say, come on, Bettina.
Come on. It's pretty cool.
Come on. Yeah. He nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm also obsessed with that movie, Enemy, Denis Villeneuve's
Enemy.
These, like, fucking huge spiders just that you're like, what was that? Yeah. I love that feeling.
Mate, you just made the hairs rise on my arm again. I just rewatched that again not that long ago, actually. Yeah. And, you know, there's some movies, like, I actually emailed Bettina last night.
She said
And I said I was, like, really looking forward to waking up at, you know, 2:30 in the morning and reminding myself that I'm nominally a grown up and I'm okay.
It's cool, like, I you know, and we met doing comedy and you know, my shorts are, they're science fiction but they're comedies, and this doing like ostensibly a horror movie or at least a thriller, you know, was so fun. It was so fun not having to try to be funny or just having to you know, have fun moments of levity for sure, but being able to, when we wanted to be like strange or scary or full of dread, but kind of just lean so hard into that, like really go for it, felt very freeing, actually.
Yeah.
I was nervous about it. I remember the other two ideas we brought into the lab were genre comedies.
Right.
One was a like a horror comedy about an influencer who has to hide that her influencer husband is turning into like a Lovecraftian, like Cronenberg-esque monster. I still might make that one. That was kind of cool. And the other one was
he's kind of becoming who he really is physically.
Just like she's like trying to hide that, you know?
Yeah.
And then the other one was like a time travel movie about a talking toaster or something. It was just ridiculous. But Monolith was clearly the one that everyone thought was cool. Like in the lab, like our mentors and stuff were like, oh, well, you know, they wouldn't tell us what to do, but they were like, that was our first job, was to pick which one we wanted to develop. And I said to Bettina, I was like, you know, haven't I done comedy? Isn't that what I should be doing? And she said to me, okay, like, let's do an exercise. You have to answer without thinking. If you could have directed any movie in history, what would it have been? And I said Alien without even a beat. Like, just like, Alien, of course.
Yeah.
It's the best movie ever. And she was like, cool, well, we'll do this one.
Great.
Yeah.
Man, good response.
Yeah.
The so you're an alien guy over aliens?
Way, yeah.
Same.
By like a wide margin.
Yeah, I love that. Once again, it's got that definitive build and, you know, and then not seeing much. And
well, the first half, I think literally the midpoint is the alien bursting out of the chest.
Yeah.
And I think that first half of that movie, especially, like the second half's great as well, but the first half, I think it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's just, it's so chilling.
Yeah.
And it, like, slow build, and then it allows you to have this amazing second half where things really kind of kick off. But fuck, man, that just that whole getting to the planet, like when they wake up, it's so slow how they wake up, and then you get to the planet and the way they explore the engineer's ship and everything. It's just mesmerizing.
There's, you know, you must have been like me where as a kid, you know, like I rewatch Prometheus every 18 months in the hope that
it's pretty cool, actually. The cool stuff in it is cool.
Yes, absolutely. That is the perfect way to describe it, because I thought about, after seeing Alien, you know, as a youngster, I thought about what the fuck was that thing?
Yeah.
What was it flying around in? What burst out of its chest?
Yeah.
Like, it must have been massive, you know, and the... you know, I don't know. I think it's one of those movies that, because it engages the imagination so much, you start to, you know, like, I remembered it having like pyramids in it with hieroglyphics and things like that. But I reckon it was looking at Geiger's artwork and other things, and then, you know, your imagination just builds this other world. So, and I think, now that you've brought up Alien, I can feel, you know, the mythology of whatever you and Lucy have created is definitively there, because it's like, I did the same thing with this. You know, I was trying to work it out, and I was creating my own mythology of what I thought might be going on.
And I actually think that's the great tragedy of Prometheus and Covenant, was that the whole reason why the first Alien works is that that stuff is unknowable.
Mm.
Like, where that came from and who that engineer is and what that ship is.
Mm.
And, like, to explain it, and it sort of works in its own merits. Like, you know, they sort of work. You know, the twist that David has created the virus or whatever is relatively cool within the context of Covenant.
Mm.
But, like, it just completely ruins what makes Alien great, which is that you can never know what that is.
Yeah.
And all you can know is that the outcome of it is this alien killing people on a spaceship.
Like, yeah, yeah.
So cool. It's such a cool feeling.
Matt, I could keep talking to you, but you have to catch a flight.
Yeah.
So the movie's released this Thursday, October 26th.
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
And can you let us know, and I'll put this up on the Facebook page as well, so people can easily find this information. But where can people check your film out?
Yeah, we can edit this part out. Let me grab the email.
Oh, mate, you've obviously not listened to this podcast. There's very little editing going on.
Well, that's cool. They'll enjoy this bit of, like, behind the scenes fair. I should know this. I know if
No, there's so many different places, and
where are we?
I saw it at Dendy Newtown.
It will be playing at Dendy Newtown.
In Sydney, which was great. I feel like in Adelaide, it was...
We're playing at the Piccadilly and the Wallace Piccadilly and Wallace Mitchum in Adelaide, and Wallace Mount Barker. Here we go. I've found the list.
Yeah.
I should... As you were out promoting a film, you really should know this stuff. But yeah, South Australia, it's the Wallace Piccadilly. I don't think... Maybe it's not on it. No, it is. Yep. Mitchum. And the Victor Cinema down in Victor Harbour.
Oh, yeah, yeah, great.
Because Bettina's from Victor Harbour, so she can play down there. New South Wales, Dendy Newtown. We're playing the Dendy Canberra as well.
Yep.
Backlot Cinema in WA. Deckchair Cinema in the Northern Territory. I got sent a lovely photo of that great... I think it's an outdoor cinema with the poster up. Looked very cool. In Queensland, we're at the Dendy Acorparo in Brisbane and Dendy Southport. And in Victoria, Cinema Nova, probably the best cinema in Australia, or at least has the best community. Like, what an amazing cinema. And the Sun Yarraville.
Yeah. I'd like to see it at the Ritz here.
Yeah.
I think it would play really well at the Ritz. So maybe, you know, I'm off to see the new David Fincher film there on Wednesday night.
I can't wait for that.
So I might,
just drop a hint. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure I have heaps of pull. Like, I sign up annually. Surely they have to listen to something I suggest.
Bring some flyers and just put them on the...
I do stand up there as well.
Oh, well, come on.
Come on, mate.
Like,
don't you know who I am? Fucking put on Monolith.
At least let them, you know, you must get to, like, you do a guest program one night, and even if it's in 6 months, you just play Monolith.
Yeah.
You know, when they let it.
Oh, mate, that'd be great. Come up with an excuse to fly up and talk more about the film.
Fuck yeah.
What's the, before you go, what's the last thing that you saw that you really loved?
God. It's been a weird year. Okay, yeah, I do have an answer. I went to Sitges, which is a genre festival in Spain. We took a film there. Really cool festival. They call it I think they're tongue-in-cheek, but they call it the Cannes of horror movies.
And right.
It's sort of got that vibe, because you're on the Spanish coast.
Yeah.
And it's like beautiful Mediterranean ocean. And like, when the Spanish films play, they're really glitzy, like, because the cast all come, the like fans are freaking out. And it was pretty amazing. It was a really fun festival. But I saw this film called Les Chambres Rouges, The Red Rooms. It's a French-Canadian film.
Yeah.
About... a woman who's, it's sort of about, and this is like a real thing that happens when violent men or serial killers or people who've done these horrible things, they'll have kind of groupies that become obsessed with them. This happened with Columbine, famously.
Yep.
And it's about a woman, a very strange woman who you don't have a lot of access to, who is obsessed with this guy who's on trial for a serial killing.
Right.
And
wow.
she's attending the trial every morning, and you're just following this character. And it is mind-blowing. It is kind of Finchery. They described it that way.
Yeah.
It's sort of like psychedelic French Fincher or something.
Great.
With a bit of Lynchian kind of... The horror of the internet is really a big thing in it. The dark web and, man, it was something.
Great.
So hopefully that comes out in Australia. I've been telling people, anyone I know in the industry, to try to distribute that here because it's very cool.
We need to set up a festival in Cairns so we can call it the Cairn of... Cairn as in come on, Cairn of... Cans.
The can.
Yeah.
The can cans.
Yeah, cans.
That'll work.
Yeah.
All dancing movies.
I have to say, if anyone gets to see you do stand up in the near future, strong as ever.
Thanks,
your emceeing in Adelaide was fantastic.
That was the best gig I'd done in ages. What a fun show that was. Yeah, that was really, really fun. You fucking killed it.
That was a fun night.
Yeah, it was really fun.
All right. I'm going to let you go because you have to catch a flight.
Yep.
Congratulations on the film.
Thanks for coming.
My best to Lucy and everyone and tell them how much I loved it. And everyone, get out there and, you know, like, don't support it because it's Australian. Go and see it because it's fucking great.
Yeah. If you like, you know, all our references are like the X-Files and this. Yep. I basically just wanted to do an X-Files episode. I was a total X-Files kid. So if you like the X-Files, please come and see our movie.
Great. Well done, mate.
Thanks.
Thanks to Matt for joining me today and inviting me last night to his screening. It was just fantastic. As I said earlier, the team have done such a great job. Lily Sullivan is overwhelmingly charismatic and compelling on the big screen. And it's out this Thursday, October 26th. So if you're looking to go to the movies and you'd like to see something, you know, please go and check this out. You know, I think you'll have a really good time. And... It's good to support the Australian movie scene, and especially when it's something that is, you know, got a different flavour to it. A quick reminder before I go, over at Patreon, you can sign up to receive bonus podcasts and other goodies if you'd like to support this podcast and be able to access all the extra work I've done. Please head to patreon.com/Justin Hamilton and find a tier that suits you. That is patreon.com/Justin Hamilton. And also keep an eye out tomorrow for the next podcast for my ongoing story, The Ultimate. You'll be able to find it here under the banner of Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted. Oh, and one last thing. Thank you to everyone who reached out about Cal Wilson in the last week. I am still quite clearly coming to terms with it all, but if you'd like to sort of know more of where I'm at, I was asked to write a piece for The Guardian about Cal. It's not... You know, it had to be something that was personal but broad and talked about Cal. And anyway, if you'd like to know kind of more where I'm at the moment with it, you can find that online. It's I'll speak more personally, you know, further down the track. But I really appreciate everyone who wrote to me and have said such lovely things about Dear Cal. And, it's been shared amongst the community and with her family as well. So, good on you people. That's it's been very sweet. So, it's a terrible loss. Oh, Cal. Beautiful, beautiful Cal. Thank you for listening to the podcast today. And if you get the opportunity to see Monolith, please let me know that you checked it out, and I hope you have a good time. Until then.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.